Produced by Preston Frazier, this is Yes Music Podcast, episode 251, Ramshackled by Alan White.
Hi, this is Billy Sherwood of Yes, and you're listening to the Yes Podcast.
This is John Davison, and you're listening to Yes Music Podcast.
Hi, this is Jeff Dales, and you're listening to Yes Music Podcast.
Hi, this is Steve Howe, and you're listening to me on the Yes Music Podcast. Have a good time. Listen. Bye.
Hi, this is John Anderson. You're listening to the Yes Music Podcast.
Welcome to episode 251 of the Yes Music Podcast, two fans' exploration of the world's greatest progressive rock band. I'm your host, Kevin Mulrine. Please remember how you can get involved with the podcast via various different ways on the site, yesmusicpodcast.com. It's great to be able to announce the first YMP patrons, who have generously pledged to support this show. The first Eddie Offord patron is Preston Frazier. Time and a Word patrons are Joseph Cottrell, Jeffrey Cresselius, and Michael O'Connor. And the Yes patrons are Paul Wilson and Jamie McQuinn. Thank you very much to those patrons who have enabled us to start migrating the website to a much more stable home from next month. If you'd like to join our first patrons in helping to support the show, just head over to patreon.com/yesmusicpodcast for details of how to get involved. That's patreon.com/yesmusicpodcast. Recently, Greg Deitz, or is it Deitz? I'm not sure, Greg, asked about older episodes of the YMP on iTunes and in the Apple Podcasts app. I had to remove a lot of the old episodes from the feed because when you have over 250, it can cause problems, as it was doing for me. In fact, I think there is an iTunes limit of 300 episodes anyway, so I would have had to have done something soon in any case. However, this means that if you listen via iTunes or the Apple Podcasts app, or actually several other podcast apps which use the iTunes directory, older episodes were unavailable. They have always been available on the YMP site, but that's not very convenient. So with Greg's prompting, I've created a new feed, which I rather grandly have called the YMP Classic Feed. It has the first 150-ish episodes on it, and you can now search for YMP Classic Feed in iTunes or the Apple Podcasts app and subscribe to it, in addition to the main podcast feed if you like. So many thanks, Greg. I've been meaning to do this for ages. This week I posted an Instagram photo of the remarkable album entitled Scambot 2 by Mike Keneally, which was kindly sent to me by David Pannell all the way from Australia. Dave tells me that Mike was the last touring guitarist with Frank Zappa's band, and this latest album from him is amazing. The artwork and the music are completely off the wall and captivating. If you're after a really dark concept album with plenty of Zappa influence and you don't tend to get scared easily, then this will be right up your alley. Just don't try listening after Lights Out. On the YMP Facebook page this week, Mark has been doing a wonderful job with album discussions, and Preston Frazier posted a link to an article about the top 10 Steve Howe solos. Joseph Cottrell found a Steve Hackett video, which features both Roynes Stolt and Lee Pomeroy on bass, which is worth a look despite not being Yes. And Chris Karam asked a question about the never-appearing second ABWH album. Joseph also posted an alternative Union Tour video from Denver, we think, which he rates more highly than the official release. And he also got his hands on the Stephen Wilson remix of Tales from Topographic Oceans. Take a look at his thoughts, which are most revealing. Pun intended. Preston went to see ARW in Atlanta and calls it a must-see despite a few sound issues with Trevor's guitar. ARW clips were posted by Jeff Bailey, Miguel Falcao, and Jark Nerit. Again, I really hope I've pronounced that correctly. And it was interesting to see the Steve Howe signature in Jeffrey Cresselius's Dan Hedges book. Steve is not amused with that particular tome. It was good to speak with Peter Greenwood of Say Yes and to see his video of The Fish to compare with Billy Sherwood and the current version by Lee Pomeroy. Also from Preston, there's his interview with John Anderson. And there are also new interviews with Jeff Downes and Billy Sherwood in preparation for the Japan tour, including whispers about Relayer. It's almost time for John Kirkman's Dialogues book, and there are lots of other Yes-related goodness on Facebook as well. On Twitter, it was good to speak to David Gordon about Bill Bruford, and I retweeted plenty of AORW material for your information. So many thanks to everyone who's been in touch in any way this week. Links for all of that are on the show notes for this week or on facebook.com/yesmusicpodcast.
Olá, sou o Miguel Falcão, de Coimbra, Portugal. Estão a ouvir o Yes Music Podcast.
This week, Mark and I are starting to look at Yes solo albums, and we've decided to start with the least well-known one, Ramshackled. Mark will give his thoughts first, then I'll do my bit, and then we'll come together to discuss the record.
This is the YMP album review from the Great White North with Mark Anthony Kay.
Greetings, friends. It's time for another album review segment. This week, I believe we are starting what is going to be, for the next couple of weeks, a focus on solo albums from the Yes members. So today I'm going to do sort of a revisit to one of them, because I believe I reviewed this record a long while back, which is Alan White's Ramshackled, which is also the album we're going to be focusing on this week for the Yes Music podcast. So let's get started with some of the basic info. I'll make it quick because I'm pretty sure I went through this already once. The record was released in 1976 on Atlantic Records. It was produced by Alan White and Bob Potter. And the album was actually recorded, according to the information that I have, in 2 days, between May 23rd to the 25th. Of 1975. What I decided to do was dig up my old notes that I had from my previous review and bring them with me, go downstairs, put on my vinyl copy of Ramshackled, listen to it again, and see if my thoughts on the album have changed at all since the last time I listened to it. I think I can say with some degree of certainty that it hasn't changed at all from my opinion of it from last time. So what was my opinion from last time? Well, my opinion in a nutshell is that this album, while it's not horrendously terrible, out of the solo albums that came out within the 1975-76 era, it is definitely the weakest. But if you were to compare this album in the grand scheme of the discography of solo records with the Yes members, it probably wouldn't be at the bottom. There are other records I could think of that were released that are much worse than this. But what is it that's good? What is it that's bad? Well, you know, Alan White, in my opinion, is one of the better rock drummers of our time. And when I first was thinking about getting this album, I was expecting to hear, you know, some rock stuff, some good drumming, you know, nothing to shatter the earth, so to speak, but, you know, something that would be rock and rolling that would get my foot going. I didn't really expect to get an album laced with Jamaican-influenced music and congas and steel drums and stuff like that. So needless to say, this record is sort of what I wasn't expecting. Let's just put it that way. Now, there are some songs on here that I find that are really good. For one, obviously, and I know everybody else would agree with this, is Song of Innocence is definitely one of the best songs on this album. And why is that? Well, because you also have John Anderson on vocals and Steve Howe on guitar. So you already have 3/5 of Yes in this song. And when you listen to it, you kind of get the feeling it could be a Yes song. So that's one of them. The opening song is pretty good. It's nothing over the top. It's sort of an island feel song again. It's called Oh Baby, Going to Pieces. And yeah, it's nothing much to talk about. Giddy is another song that seems really odd. It's more of these conga drum things, and the lyrics are pretty bad. And really the song that also had a video for it, which is a song called Silly Woman, is a song that I'm very confused of. I mean, out of all the songs he could have made a video for, I know that they have one for Song of Innocence, which makes sense, but they also have one for this. And this song is really just not good. Just like a really bad attempt at reggae music, in my opinion. I think that he should have really tried to stick more with the rock kind of feel. But if there's one song on here besides Song of Innocence that redeems it, it's definitely the closer of the record, Darkness Part 1 to 3. Much better, more interesting feel. The singing is a lot better. There's, you know, great piano playing in there. And there's a real hints of progressive music in it as well. So this is much closer to what I expected to hear from this record. So at least that's on there to kind of redeem itself, in my opinion. I mean, the one other thing about this that I found really strange was the vocals overall were really dry. There's no reverb or any kind of delay. Or it's just like if you were to listen to this on headphones, the guy's singing in your ear almost. It's so upfront. So not really my kind of style of production either. Now, there's also one other thing about this record that I found really odd. Being that this is an Alan White solo record, you would figure that he's probably going to be the dominant writer of this record. Now, we all know Alan can write music. He's written quite a few pieces for Yes stuff throughout the years. So it came to quite a surprise to me that absolutely nothing from this record was written by Alan. It was all written by either Kenny Craddock or Colin Gibson or Pete Kirtley. Now, Kenny is the piano player, organist, and singer. Colin Gibson is the bass player, percussionist, and Pete Kirtley is the electric and acoustic guitar player, as well as vocals, I'm very sure. So the fact that these people wrote most of the music makes me wonder if maybe Alan was a little pressed for time. I mean, he only had 2 days now. I don't know if that's because he could only afford to take that much time to do it. Maybe there was something coming up and he couldn't do much more than that, but maybe he was under pressure and he had to use stuff that they already had available to him. So yeah, that's another thing that I found kind of odd about this record. So I guess out of 10, I'm not sure what I gave it back then, but I'm going to just go straight down the middle, give it a 5 out of 10. It's not fantastic, it's not horrible, it's just in the middle. I'm curious to hear what Kevin has to say, and of course we're curious to hear what you have to say about the record. How do you feel this record stacks up in the great catalog that is the Yes discography? Is this your favorite solo record? Is it your least favorite? Let us know on the Yes Music podcast comments page. And I'm sure we're going to get to Kevin's opinion, and we'll also be talking about it together and see what we think about it. So until next week, this is Mark Anthony Kay saying bye for now.
Rather than finding out a lot about this album, I thought I'd throw myself in at the deep end and just listen to what I understand is the least well appreciated of the Yes members' solo efforts in 1976. This is another album I don't own a physical copy of, so I got hold of the YouTube link and took a look at the brief notes which the uploader has provided. The first thing which brought me up short was the writing credits on the 9 tracks. When you compare this to Elias, which was written, performed, and recorded by Anderson himself, it looks rather odd to have not one single mention of Alan White amongst the composers of the tracks. Is that right? Did he add drum parts and therefore should be credited? I'm not sure until I'll take a look at some other source of information later. If he did create the drum parts, then he's rather at odds with Bill Bruford, who I can't imagine being happy not to be mentioned on the credits. Anyway, the list of musicians is also interesting to me, at first glance, as Anderson, Howe and Mraz are all there, as I knew on Spring Song of Innocence, which is the only track I've heard before today. In fact, Mraz only has a cameo appearance on the video for the track and doesn't play on it at all, I understand. One name I do recognise is David Bedford. I assume that's the same David Bedford as appeared very briefly in my music degree when we did a session on classical music of the 1970s. He's credited with orchestral arrangements and conducting, which would fit. To be honest, I don't recognise any of the other names. First up is Ooh Baby Going to Pieces by Peter Kirtley. Alan White clearly had a track record of working in a variety of musical fields when he came out with Ramshackled. There was the pop rock of the Plastic Ono Band on the one hand, and the prog of Yes on the other hand. So which way would this record slant? Both? One way or the other? Neither? Well, I have to say that my initial reaction to the start of the album is something along the lines of, what on earth is this? The drumming is great in a kind of dance band manner, with the bass line creeping in a kind of 70s disco vibe, with skittish guitar and some nice organ, but I'm not really sure what to make of it. A synth break leads to the vocals, which are a bit like a slightly tamer version of Barry White. Barry White light, maybe. This certainly isn't anything like I was expecting. There are some breaks and there's lots of energy, but it's all rather odd to my ears. I'm really not sure how to categorise it. I can well imagine the bemused expressions of many a Yes fan on hearing this for the first time. There's a British comedian called Lenny Henry who used to do a character called Theophilus P. Wildebeest, and this track reminds me somewhat of that. Sorry if that's rather lost on you. I can appreciate the drumming of Mr. White, it's really in the groove of the music, but I can't say I really like the overall effect. The track fades out, and then we're on the way to One Way Rag. White is at the core of this groove as well, and it's fun, but I can't help thinking of Starsky and Hutch. It's not really like that disco-funk feel, but the vocals are quite glamorous and spangly. Again, I'm almost lost for words. It's more Bee Gees than King Crimson, complete with a sexually charged sax solo. Again, fun music, but not something I can see myself coming back to a great deal. The next track has the intriguing name Avacac, which sounds quite proggy. There is more sax here and piano. It's contemplative and attractive music with a bit of a lilt to it. The mood suddenly changes and there's a fusion-style vamp on the piano and drums complemented by jazzy sax and bass, with White's stylish drumming shown off in its brilliance. This track is a lot more engaging. It feels very much in a jazz fusion mode, and there's a contrasting portion in an interesting time signature. There are shades of perhaps Miles Davis or someone, and a lot to sustain the interest as it ebbs and flows from section to contrasting section. There's even a bit of King Crimson, Lark's Tongues and Aspic type insanity thrown in, with bits and pieces of what sounds like vegetable matter being mixed in a surreal bowl of magic. Then there are great improvised sounding guitar and sax solos. It's a heady mix of mayhem and madness. Brilliant fun, with White pinning it all down to the split millisecond with immaculate timing. It finishes with some highly bizarre vocal acrobatics, which sound like an African throat-singing epilogue or something. A wonderful and fascinating mix, which I imagine would work well as a soundtrack to a hallucinogenic out-of-body experience. Blimey. Well, now we're back to maybe to a more recognisable fare with Spring Song of Innocence, which I remember enjoying when I watched the video of it some time ago. There's a naturalistic sound at the beginning, with undulating piano, guitar and cymbals, which then breaks into a naive tune on lead and acoustic guitars to introduce John Anderson's vocals. The lyrics are from the poet William Blake and they work well. There's also an effective bass line weaving in and out and sitar-like guitar effects. It's a bit of a hippie flower power vibe with flute consorts and gently airy vocals. It's so laid back it's in danger of falling over, but I do like the overall effect. It succumbs to a repeated phrase at the end before more piano leads to a fade out. A good piece which benefits from Yes Men, Howe and Anderson. Then we're back to the Los Angeles of the 1970s with the faintly comic and ridiculous Giddy. Listen to the lyrics for a bit of a giggle. I don't really have much of a frame of reference for this. There's a great synth solo and then a guitar one followed by the orchestral arrangements presumably by Bedford. And it flies on in fine style, if you like that kind of thing. I'm not really sure I do. Motown is added to the mix and the strings give it a bit of a Phil Spector wall of sound character. And I absolutely applaud White for trying something completely different to his day job, but in the end it's not my bag, brother. Silly Woman has a quasi-reggae beat and it's a toe-tapper with an attractive quirky quality. Here come the steel drums and of course the drumming is top-notch. Once again though, it's much less of an Alan White fest than I'd expect from a solo album. This could easily be a single and the production is good. It's a punchy and full sound with great backing singing and instrumental arrangement. It's a fun track. Marching Into a Bottle starts with a Howe-esque acoustic guitar, which is then joined by a flute and a clarinet and an oboe. It's a lovely tune with good arrangement. Even a bassoon gets a go. There are bells shaking and claves clicking in the background. Is that all Alan White gets to do? A tiny fragment of a piece. Everybody has a false start, with what sounds like a crashing wave at the end of it. Then we're back into a pure 70s groove, complete with horn section and some brilliant fiery drumming from White. The steel drums are back and we're transported once again to the US for an energetic romp. There's a bit of fusion-style jazzy piano and it's engaging stuff with some dramatic vocals. However, it suddenly cuts off with an odd noise, which is bizarre. So finally, we're on to Darkness Parts 1 to 3. This sounds like a prog-type title, but let's see. There's an interesting opening with muted guitar and then a walking tempo groove is set up with bluesy singing. There are trumpets as the lyrics talk about walking about at night. There are interesting changes of time and mandolin combines with trumpet and Hammond organ. It sounds like it might grow into something more substantial and the solo guitars with strings bring us to what seems like the end of the first part. It appears to be programmatic. Perhaps we are to think that we are walking through different parts of a city. The singer speaks directly to darkness in intriguing lyrics and the instrumental arrangements also hold the interest. A trumpet solo depicts a dark, slumbering city scene and we move into a waltz. Maybe a couple are out dancing in the moonlight. Oh. And that's where it all ends. I was expecting another section or a recapitulation or something. So that track had some promise, but it seems cut short. Overall, it's a sprawling collection of disparate styles and approaches with no clear thread to hang on to. Some moments are worthwhile, but I'd love to know exactly what Alan White was thinking when he was putting it together. I'm going to see what the various Yes books have to offer on the topic. Not a great deal, actually. Dave Watkinson describes Ramshackled as the Yes solo album of the time, which strayed furthest away from the Yes aesthetic. White himself produced it, and there was a single released. Dave points out that Alan returns to his rhythm and blues and rock roots here. Thomas J. Mosbo, I'm really not sure how to pronounce his surname, tells us that Ramshackled shows us how White is able to fit into any musical situation and provide the perfect accompaniment, even when, as on Ramshackled, the music is less than inspiring. According to his book Yes, But What Does It Mean?, White was the only Yes member not to write material for their solo album, and used it as an opportunity to give exposure to his pre-Yes, pre-Plastic Ono Band collaborators. And that makes a lot of sense. Wikipedia gives me a bit of a hand in classifying the music. It describes the genre of the record as jazz fusion, art rock, pop, rock and soul. So, quite a wide range then. One Way Rag was played on the solo album tour by Yes, but this and the other solo tracks were dropped pretty soon. It turns out that I was right about David Bedford, who collaborated with Prog's own Mike Oldfield, but his work on the album doesn't really set it alight. Not his fault, I'm sure. Wikipedia ends by including quite a good summary from AllMusic.com. Their reviewer, Alex Anderson, found the album highly uneven and noted that the album's hodgepodge of popular styles failed to appeal to the progressive rock fanbase White had gained with Yes. He concluded, "Although Ramshackled isn't terrible, most of the Yes fans who bought it agreed that their money hadn't been well spent." So there you have it. That's what I think of Ramshackled, and also what Mark thinks of Ramshackled. And here he is. Hello, Mark.
Hello, Kevin. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Yourself?
Very good, thanks.
Great. All right then, so Ramshackled, I think we probably share pretty much the same opinion of the album. It's interesting. It strikes me as a very odd collection of seemingly unconnected tracks. But the thing I really wanted to ask you about is, do you agree that it and I think you do, that it really just doesn't feel like a solo album?
No, I mean, I know that you mentioned it as well in your segment, that the thing that struck me, and I don't know why it didn't strike me the very first time I did the review of this record, I didn't mention it, but it really struck me hard this time, was that the fact that he didn't write a single song on this album. No. His own solo record, and there's not a single Alan White credit for songwriting, which is very odd to me. I had my own theories on that, but that is one of the things that I found very strange about it.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear you saying that it was recorded in a very, very short period of time, and that reminds me a bit of things like Heaven and Earth, but we won't go there just at the moment because we're talking about Ramshackled. But yes, a very strange ragtag sort of selection of tracks which seem to have been very, very hurriedly thrown together. But yes, you're right. He added so much to Yes songs over the years, and I was reading a little bit in one of the books about how he felt his songwriting contributed to Yes, and the fact that he used to sometimes, although he wasn't a great pianist, a great guitarist, he used to noodle around a bit on those instruments and rework things that other people had done, and Steve Howe would come in and say, "Oh, that's good, play that again," and we'll integrate that into the music. And certainly since Ramshackled, he's done a decent amount of composing and writing on his own, hasn't he?
Oh, yeah. I mean, like you said, I mean, there's even recently there's been little things brought up about how he's been at the piano at the right time, and
yeah,
he's played something that somebody's ears got perked up with. I mean, even as far as Magnification, you know, In the Presence Of is very much an Alan White song. I mean, it stemmed from his whole, him playing on the piano, and that whole introduction is pretty much his idea.
Yes, that's right. So an interesting sort of footnote in Yes history, I suppose. But when we get on to the other solo albums of the time, I think we will really find that it doesn't quite stack up to those other ones, as we've already said. But let's just think about this a bit more generally then. And why do you think band members of successful bands, because Yes is not the only example of this by a long way, why do those band members suddenly feel that they need to record solo albums? I mean, we know a little bit about Eliza Sunhillo and why John Anderson was motivated to do that. It was all about him proving himself to be a proper musician. But what do you think? Why do successful band members often go off and want to do their own thing on a solo album?
Well, I mean, there's a few examples of this, and you know, I've seen and read about a few bands that have done this over the years. I mean, and I find that there's usually two reasons. One is because they've gotten to that point where they've amassed so much material, and sometimes it's not being used in songs. That sometimes they just feel that it might be a good idea to go ahead and have all solo projects so that they can get all these little ideas that they have
off of their shoulders, because a lot of the times when you're not getting your stuff accepted into the band project, you start getting some frustrations and some resentments. And usually a good way to get rid of those is to put yourself into those situations where they say, okay, you know what, let's just all go do what we want, and we'll come back in a year and continue on as we were normally. A lot of bands did that, some more successful than others. I mean, Kiss tried it and it completely backfired on them. They did their four solo records, and then the one guy thought, because it did so well, that I don't need you guys anymore, you know? So, you know, and that wasn't really the case with Yes. I think with Yes, and I think I remember vividly hearing that it was John Anderson in that documentary that I posted a few weeks ago on there, saying that after Relayer, he just thought that it was going so bananas after that. He said, I think his exact words were, guys, we're going to break up the band here. So let's go out and just do some solo stuff and we'll come back. Because I think that they were just probably going in so many different directions by that point that maybe they couldn't just find a cohesive center point and just said, you know what, let's just put all our crazy ideas on our own records and we'll come back. You know, and I think that's probably one of the reasons why they do it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely right. I'm sure that's the case. And interesting that it was the point at which Yes had Patrick Mraz in the band rather than Rick Wakeman. Of course, Rick Wakeman's amazing solo career, and in some ways that eclipsed, maybe not, but in some ways it eclipsed what Yes had done. But we're coming back to people like Mraz's solo work, which was really rather more remarkable than Ramshackled, perhaps. You've created solo records. What's the process like, and what was the motivation for you?
Well, I mean, it is definitely two different worlds, because on one hand, there's pros and cons. I mean, when you're working in a band situation, you have the advantage of more ideas, where you have another person who you can bounce off of, who might have other ideas you might not have thought of. You might also have a member of the band who's much better at, let's say, lyric writing than you are, so you have that element in there. Mm. Now, when you turn it all around, now all of a sudden, and you have it all in your lap, suddenly you find you have a heck of a lot more to do than you did before. Now you have to think of the lyrics, all the melodies, everything, and suddenly it becomes quite a big undertaking. But by that same token, in a band situation, the con is that sometimes you may not see eye to eye on a piece. They might show you something and you might say, I don't like that, and they're really adamant that they want it. Yeah. So you have that little bit of headbutting. Whereas when you do a solo thing, you don't have to butt heads with anybody. So there's that element of, you know, the plus and the minus.
Yeah, and it's interesting as well, isn't it, when you think about it, that some people have gone off into whole careers. I'm thinking particularly of someone like Peter Gabriel. And what he did was he's in charge, but he doesn't create music on his own. I mean, he isn't an Elias-type worker at all. He doesn't record everything, play everything himself. Someone like Mike Oldfield in the early days, of course, did everything, absolutely everything himself. And that's one way of doing it. But Peter Gabriel collected musicians around him, but he was in charge. And that's a very different thing, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, on one hand, like you said, he isn't writing everything himself. He is definitely bringing in people to write the music with him.
Yeah.
But because he's in charge of the project and it's his project, he has the advantage of saying, what kind of music would I want to do on this record? And who do I think I'd be able to get to help me get to that point? You know, yeah. I mean, David Bowie was that way too. He had Mick Ronson in the early days. And then when he decided to start doing albums like, you know, Young Americans and stuff like that, where he went more soul, he brought in like Carlos Alomar and these other people who we knew would help him get to that point. So when you're in a solo position, that's helpful too, because when you have a name like Gabriel had, he could probably pick, you know, pretty much who he wanted to help with his records. And that also got help him see his vision a bit better.
Yes, that's right. And it's interesting, isn't it? Because in some ways, I suppose, when you are wedded to a band, you've got those band members. And of course, yes, I've had the attitude over the years that if one person isn't working, you throw them out and you get another person in. So that it does work. And that's a different way, again, of thinking about it. But yes, to feel that you are that core set of musicians, and the example I always give is of course Queen, and they were particularly in the early days absolutely adamant that it was the four of them, nothing else was done by anyone else. And that's a very different opinion to say someone like Robert Fripp, who just spent the whole of his career picking and choosing, as you've just been saying, different musicians for different effects, for different ways of working that he wanted to do, but it was very definitely all him the whole time. So absolutely fascinating stuff. And yes, when we come on to someone like Chris Squire, Fish Out of Water, that feels very much like Chris's record, but it's certainly not just Chris. There's so much more going on in that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he had people that he, trusted, and I'm sure he was probably friends with for quite a while. And that also helps, too, when you have people that you can trust and who you're comfortable with writing music with. It usually shows. And I mean, Chris is a great example of a person who you can tell works much better in a band dynamic than solo, because, right. I mean, he's only had one real solo outing. I mean, and I remember on the Yes Years documentary, he was mentioning even back then when they were filming it that he mentioned how it had been, you know, several years since he made a record, and that he was thinking about doing another one at that point. And that was like 91 when they did that documentary or so. Mm-hmm. So even then he mentioned about doing it and he still didn't get around to doing it. So I always feel that he's one of these guys that worked better in a group situation. And when he was solo, he didn't maybe work as productively.
Yes, that's right. And it's fascinating. I was reading the books this week, and Chris Squire said that the experience of doing those solo albums at that time simply served to remind the band members how great it was to work together.
Yeah, exactly.
When they
yeah.
came back together again. But of course, when they did come back together, there was no Meraz, and Rick Wakeman was brought back in at that point. So yes, it was fascinating listening to Ramshackled. I did enjoy it, but you know, when you compare it to something like Chris's Fish Out of Water, to Elias, and right up to date to something like collaborations which have happened, like the Anderson Stolt collaboration, it's just not in the same league at all. It feels very much, and you know, in a way, Ramshackled is a very good name for it, because it's such an odd collection just thrown together in a very ramshackle manner. But anyway, that means that we've looked at the first one, and we'll carry on next week with a different solo album. So thank you very much, Mark.
You're welcome.
This is Two Pence with Mark Anthony Kay and Kevin Mulrine.
So for this week's Two Pence, Mark, we have a slightly controversial Two Pence, don't we?
Yeah, it's interesting. During these last couple of days especially, there's been a lot of discussion back and forth about, the usual thing, you know, how is ARW compared to Yes? Are they playing the songs better than Yes? So on and so forth. The usual back and forth. And during these conversations, I was talking with a few people, and something came up that I thought was really interesting and that I figured we should talk about. Is somebody mentioned on there that, just in sort of passing, they said if Chris hadn't passed away, Chris Squire, obviously, that ARW probably would not have happened. And then when I heard this statement, or better yet, when I read this statement, it kind of took me aback for a moment, and I thought about it, and I go, well, why is that? I mean, what made this person think that? I mean, my first reaction to that comment is, I don't see what difference it would have made to me if he was alive or not alive in them making ARW. But, you know, that was just my first reaction to that.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Well, I was thinking about it. I think it's a fascinating Two Pence to get stuck into. And I was thinking about it in three ways. And here are the three ways that I'd like to go through. First of all, why have they done it at all? Secondly, why have they done it now? And that's going to come very much into the Chris question, I think. And thirdly, is it working? What's our opinion on this week? Or what is it, the second week? Going into the third week, maybe, of the whole project being live, playing live. So let's go back to that first question. Why have they done it? And I had some thoughts about that. There are things like they may be riding on this wave, this resurgence of interest in things like Yes, and you had the Anderson Ponty Band, you had Anderson Stolt, and the Six Wives. So Anderson and Wakeman, extremely, extremely popular at the moment and in the public eye. Although they did have to, they did start thinking about ARW a long time ago. So is part of it the fact that they're buoyed up by and encouraged by the amount of interest there is in their music at the moment?
I would say that definitely has a lot to do with it. I mean, all you have to do is go on to a site like Yes Fans, for example, and you'll see, you know, there's always people talking about all these kinds of different, you know, combinations of people of what if this happened or what if that happened. And that was one of those ones that came up like a long time ago where people were saying, you know, because when John and Rick were playing together, when they did the Living Tree, people loved it.
Yeah.
And then people were thinking about, you know, expanding on it. And then when that little bit of information came down the line that John was talking to Trevor again and how Rick mentioned that he would have loved to have worked with Trevor before, I think it kind of started snowballing and that they actually started taking it seriously, like a serious thing to consider doing.
Yeah. And it's interesting, when you go onto Wikipedia and look up ARW, it says active date 2010 to the present, which is fascinating. Yeah. because really we perhaps think of it more as just having happened, but in fact it's been on the cards for such a long time. The other aspect I was thinking, though, was financial. Now, I don't think financially Rabin needed to do this. The others, not so sure. You know, they're enjoying great popularity at the moment. That doesn't necessarily mean great financial security, maybe. But finance got anything to do with it?
Well, I mean, let's put it this way. Whenever I think of finance and supergroups, quote unquote, usually it's when I think about money part of it, it's usually those ones where you look at it and go, wow, I never thought those guys would ever want to work with each other because something bitter happened with them and they broke apart on, you know, bad terms. Yes. So that usually is the alarm bell where it's money, because they got back together because usually they despise each other. There would be no other reason to do it except money. Mm. But I don't get that vibe with this. With this, I get more that it's something that they wanted to do. You know, with John, you know, who knows? I mean, he wants to do 17 projects next week already. So, you know, this just could have been one of the things that he was really wanting to do. And he started pushing to do it. And I know Rick wanted to do it. But, you know, Trevor was always the holdout, right? He was always like, you know, I'm doing this and the timing is not right. And, you know, for him to drop those kind of commitments to do it, it's a big thing for him. So to him, it's almost like he's giving up a bit of money security to do this.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that John has deep within him, he has a desire, a need to keep Yes going in whatever form he can. Of course, he was the creator along with Chris Squire of Yes. And I'm sure he really still wants to sing those songs and to continue the legend that he created. And of course, you've already mentioned it, that John Anderson, Rick Wakeman, wonderful friendship, and they've made some amazing music together over the years. And yes, I imagine it is Rabin who had to be convinced to do it. And perhaps I think that Rick Wakeman might have had a lot to do with that convincing. So Rabin needed to want to play Yes Music live and perhaps relive those glory days of talk when he was, you know, in some ways in charge of the band's direction, perhaps even, and relive the amazing Union Tour when, of course, he did play with the two guys up there with him now. And maybe there's a little bit about whether he wants to regain some of that youth that perhaps he feels is lost now. He's been stuck in a studio doing and recording soundtrack music for so long and hasn't been out there touring for a very long time. So perhaps that's part of it as well.
Well, I can say definitely that that's a big part of it. Because, I mean, speaking for myself, for example, I was a person who was in a band and playing live constantly. Like for like 9 months of the year, I was always, you know, having a concert that I'm going to be doing or, you know, a tour coming up. And then now when I'm doing my solo thing, I've been now more relegated into a studio situation. And now you get that itch. So I can only imagine for someone like Trevor, who's been in there for several years now doing this and hasn't played live, he must be, you know, he must have been sort of bursting at the seams to do it. Because, I mean, on one hand, yeah, the money's probably great. He can do whatever he wants in a, you know, in a movie kind of capacity. Yeah. He doesn't need to answer to anybody except maybe just, you know, movie producers. But other than that, he's his own boss.
Yeah.
But to get back into this situation, you really need to want to do it. It is hard work. And, you know, I think that he needed to convince himself that he could do it as well, because it's hard work. He's singing, he's playing guitar, you know. It's not as simple as people think it is, you know.
Absolutely not. So going on to why have they done it now? So the ARW, Anderson, Rabin, Wakeman, have gone on record saying that Chris Squire's passing was definitely part of the catalyst. They'd been talking about doing ARW for a long time, but when Chris passed away, I think it gave them a bit of a spur, gave them a jolt to recognise that everyone's mortal, we're not here for eternity. And maybe that's part of it, a big part of it. They convinced Trevor by saying, look, this is maybe the last chance we've got to do this thing.
Yeah, I think that's definitely an element as well. I mean, you know, John is in his 70s now, you know, and Rick is, you know, very much around the same bracket. And Trevor's a little bit younger, but he's not getting any younger either. So it definitely gets to that point, I'm sure, with all musicians that, you know, once you reach a certain age in your life, you start taking things seriously, you start appreciating things more seriously, you start becoming more forgiving of people and start mending bridges, I find, quickly, because you don't want to, you know, have that moment where maybe somebody passes and you didn't clear up things with them. You know, that's sort of a thing that's sort of sad to think about, right? So yeah. I think that has an element to do with it. Maybe Chris passing on maybe gave them that extra little fuel that they needed to get it rolling.
Mm, that's right. It reminds me of someone like the American composer who I'm very keen on, Aaron Copland. And towards the end of his life, he spent the last few years not composing any new music, but putting all the music he had composed into order, you know, editing it, making sure it was mm-hmm. ready and right. And that was the last thing he wanted to do. He wanted his legacy to be this body of work exactly as he wanted it. And perhaps that's a bit of it as well, that they want to get out there and do this thing for the one last time. Interesting to see if they do produce some recorded music as well. But one slightly, and that's very positive, I think it's fantastic that they're doing that, but one slightly less positive aspect might be, would you think that particularly John, maybe Rick, were unhappy with the current touring Yes's continued success and fame? maybe they're, you know, a little bit jealous of what's going on there.
Yeah, you know, there's, you know, whether people admit it or not, there's always going to be a little bit of that with musicians. There's always that competitiveness that's within them, and especially when you've been in a band together that's successful. And for some whatever yeah. reason, whether it's John not being let back in or Rick leaving and then, you know, always having a sort of chip on his shoulder about, you know, it not being Yes unless John is there. And that always seeming to be his reason for not going back to the original sort of Yes. Mm. You know, I think that they were kind of caught by surprise, to be honest with you, because when Benoit left, I think a lot of them thought that was the end of it, that's yes. it. They're not going to continue. And once John Davison came in and did it so brilliantly and has continued to be such a strong force, I mean, now he is so etched in there now. I can't even think of another singer right now for Yes that I would rather hear right now. John does it so perfectly and wonderfully. I love it. And it's one of those situations where for the first time in a long time, I can see Yes, the one with Steve Howe and Alan, those guys, continuing for a while, you know, because they have a really strong foundation now. I mean, you got Billy and John in there, and they're, you know, they're at least, you know, what, 20 years younger than these guys. So the length that this band can continue is pretty infinite from this point on. And I think that kind of maybe bugs them a bit that they're not maybe involved in this a bit, you know, and that's just the way it is sometimes, because, you know, people expect one thing to happen, and when it doesn't happen, it sometimes rubs people the wrong way.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And what about Chris not being there, though? I mean, this is perhaps the kernel inside of what we're saying here. Chris was a huge character. He was larger than life. He was, intimidating, maybe that's the wrong word. But was he, do you think, a major blocker? Was he that kind of character? And do they think now that perhaps the legitimacy of the touring Yes without Chris there is slightly less than it was? Is this the best time for ARW to kind of launch themselves now that Chris is not there, blocking the progress in that in whatever way they thought maybe he was?
Well, there's no doubt that Chris Squire is and always was sort of like the figurehead of Yes, you know. He was like the big representative of the band, you know. Whenever there was a record that came out, I'm sure most media people were saying, you know, I want to go talk to Chris Squire.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I think that with him gone, obviously people didn't expect maybe as much of it, maybe it for it to be as strong without him there. Mm. But I think the smartest thing that happened was that when Chris went and formally asked Billy to come in and be his replacement, and he, like, you know, actually made it public knowledge that he hand-selected Billy.
Yes.
I think that that whole, you know, it being weakened with him gone was erased, because he picked somebody that he trusted, somebody he worked a long time with, people, somebody that people already knew and knows that he's a strong musician. Yeah. So I think that that part of it is sort of gone. But I think that, you know, on one hand, with him not being there, yeah, sure, maybe they felt that, you know, there may not be some bridges blocked with Chris gone now, you know, so maybe that's why this, you know, got going so much quicker with him now not around.
Yeah, yeah. And in some ways it's a bit of a disappointment thinking that Chris may have been one of the reasons why they didn't do this earlier. But on the other hand, it was also the catalyst, and so it's great. You know, I'm very pleased that they are out there doing it. However, evidence from the latest videos, we've watched those. They haven't changed the set list very significantly, certainly not added any really exciting new things. My point of view, they seem still a bit ragged. So my question is ARW working?
Oh, okay. So this is going to be this is going to be something where, no matter how we kind of discuss this, I'm sure we're going to get feedback on this. But I look at it like this. Because Trevor hasn't been on stage for a while, he has some rust to overcome. And it's pretty evident. I mean, when you see some of these videos that are out now, especially Awaken, I mean, the song that everybody was looking forward to hearing. And I mean, sorry, guys, you can argue this with me till you're blue in the face and you're not going to change my opinion of this. That song has been suffering on this tour. They have been botching spots on that quite a bit. It's been shaky, and Trevor has been, you know, at the front of some of the shakiness. And, you know, videos don't lie. I mean, you can even see on their faces. Sometimes Lee Pomeroy gives them this kind of look where he kind of smiles like, you know, oops, I caught you there with that mistake kind of look. And, you know, they just need to smoothen things up a bit. And one of the things that I've always talked about with other young musicians is that there's a difference between, you know, serious long-term practicing of a band and then a band that gets put together slapdash. Now, I know these guys are not just, you know, new musicians or nothing, but to me, this is where the difference between Yes and ARW comes into play. Mm. Yes have been playing with each other for a long time now. They know each other's quirks. They've been on stage together for a long time, and they're gelled. They're a very well-oiled machine. ARW are not at that point, not anywhere near it. You know, they didn't have nearly as much rehearsal time together as Yes have, and it shows. And I mean, they're playing songs that are not exactly easy either. You know, Hard as a Sunrise, Awaken. You know, these songs, you know, you can't just expect to do 2 weeks of rehearsals and have it down, compared to a band that's been playing it now for years and years together.
Yeah. And you can tell Rick Wakeman, I think, is really flowing. It's not perfect, but he's flowing much more than Trevor, for example. And I think John is doing well as well. But you're right, it's them as a unit that I don't think is quite there yet. The other thing also, of course, looking from some of the videos shot from backs of halls, the halls aren't actually full either, which is a bit of a shame. Maybe they should have done fewer concerts, although we get into promoter territory there, don't we? Fewer concerts later in time, so to give the band more time to practice and gel and so on, because it's a little bit disappointing at the moment watching those videos, isn't it?
Yeah, and I mean, I think also as well that if they would have given themselves a bit more time in between shows, I think that would be more beneficial for someone like John, because, you know, I've been watching some of these videos, and while John's been doing really good, actually, I mean, a lot better than I thought that maybe he would have.
Yeah.
And I only say that because having to do so many shows in a row, especially at his age, it can try on someone's voice, you know?
Mm.
And you know, I listened to them doing like And You and I, he's been starting to, you know, adjust some of these melodies. He's been starting to avoid some of these higher notes now. So, you know, is he avoiding it because he can't do it? Or is it just because now he's starting to get maybe, you know, a little raspy in the voice early on? Who knows why he's doing it? But, you know, these are concerns that I would have, you know, if I was in the band. You know, you got to give this guy recovery time as well, right? And I mean, that's another point too. Like you said, these are not completely sellout concerts they're doing. Maybe if they made them less of them, maybe people would, you know, maybe the other events would sell out because it would force more people to go to less shows, right?
Yep. Okay. That's very interesting. And it's a shame, but hopefully it will improve. Now, if you have actually been to an ARW concert, and I know that there are Yes Music podcast listeners out there who have, then tell us we're wrong. Okay. Send us an email, show@yesmusicpodcast.com, record a voicemail on the site, or even volunteer to come on and tell us we're wrong in person on the show. We'd love to know that we are wrong and that ARW are doing brilliantly. So thank you very much indeed, Mark.
You're welcome, Kevin.
I've an All Yes Music podcast every week. I love to hear what Kevin says. I've an All Yes Music podcast every week. I love to hear what Kevin says.
So that's just about all the time we have this week. Thanks so much for listening once again. We'll be back next week, but in the meantime, please do get involved with the podcast yourself by signing up as a patron at patreon.com/yesmusicpodcast, by subscribing to the podcast via your podcatcher or web service of choice, or getting involved on facebook.com/yesmusicpodcast or via Instagram. So until next week, just remember, whatever your progressive rock question, the answer is yes.